The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Good evening, everybody. It's April 18th, Tuesday. We're going to start with the governor's proposal, Senate File 2233, House File 2486, and we will be adjourning at 7 o'clock for everybody's purpose here tonight. So welcome, Commissioner France. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, and Ms. Rayton. Rayton?
Yes, did I get that correct?
Thank you very much. Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Pension Commission. Appreciate the opportunity to come tonight. We've handed out a sort of a slide deck copy of just some general parameters of the governor's budget. I'm not going to walk through that in detail because Ms. Rayton is going to go through the governor's budget. But we've also handed out some sheets showing where the general fund dollars are for the governor's proposed pension reform changes. And I think that's really where I want to start, and that is to make clear that the governor's budget proposal does include funding for most, if not all, of the pension recommendations that you have received. The commission has received recommendations from all the different pension funds, and the governor has recommended financing most, although not all, of those recommendations. So I just want to make a few brief opening remarks, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Rayton to go through the bill. And we really want to stress the nature of this commission and the nature of this work in terms of being a bipartisan effort. We believe that it must be done to maintain the fiscal integrity of the state and to keep the promises made to the workers who dedicated their careers to serving Minnesotans. But in recent years, maintaining sound public pension funding has risen in importance. Rating agencies have increased their focus on public pension plan funding. Reports of dire pension funding situations across the nation have heightened concerns and awareness for the need for this continual review. And we must make sure that we have strong and conservative management and proactive adjustments to keep the pension plans healthy and be able to provide the benefits earned and promised to the plan members. Now, the Minnesota pension plans in particular continue to perform above the national average in terms of funded ratios and the percentage of state spending needed to support them. Minnesota's plans provide relatively modest benefits to members who contribute more than the national average towards their own benefits. We must continue Minnesota's history of proactive and thoughtful management of pension funds and implementing fiscally sound plan changes when needed. I think that has been the key to Minnesota's success, is making changes when needed instead of waiting until the situation was dire. So what the governor has proposed is a balanced, fiscally sound reform of our pension set, our pension plans. Each set of recommendations that he's made reflect the needs of each particular plan. They include changes such as the increased employer contribution, increased employee contributions, reductions of some retiree COLAs, and other plan changes. The governor's recommendation also includes a reduction of the investment return assumption of 7.5% for all plans. The recommendations reflect the values and conclusions of the Blue Ribbon Panel that the governor put together this last fall. And included in the Blue Ribbon Panel recommendations were the need to reduce the investment return discount rate assumption, and it also supported many of the plan changes that have been brought forward by the plans and provide funding for the employers to offset their costs. So the funding portion of the governor's proposal was included in the governor's budget released on January 24th. Now, number one, those funding proposals are contained in each agency's budget recommendations through the operating increase for every agency. So you have to go to every agency's budget and their operating adjustment increase to see where the dollars are. And you'll see on one of the handouts where it says operating increases general fund, that shows you the amount of the pension proposal funded by the governor in the agency budget recommendation. And then number two, the governor has proposed increasing the education budget bill as part of the school aid formula to pay for that part of the pension reform that goes toward the school districts. So just to summarize and then turn it over to Ms. Rayton, fixing our pension system is not really what we consider fodder for political negotiations. It is not what we consider to be a bargaining chip, but rather is a bipartisan need for this commission and the governor to come together, to work together. And so I urge this commission as a bipartisan body of the legislature to include funds for the pension reform as needed for the state. And if it's okay, Madam Chair, we'll have Ms. Raton go through the bill or questions if you prefer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for Commissioner France so far? Commissioner, who was on that blue panel group?
Well, first of all, former Legislative Commission Chair Maury Lanning from Moorhead. I think I can remember most of them. Tom Borman, a lawyer in Minneapolis. Mr. Wells Fargo, Jim Campbell, one of the Wells Fargo executives. And a woman from the University of Minnesota. I'm remembering her name is Professor Colleen Manchester from the Carlson School of Management. David Crosby, a managing director of Piper Jaffray. Jim Campbell that I mentioned, Brenda Brannon. She's a chief wealth management officer at the North Shore Bank of Commerce in Duluth, Minnesota. Sam Kaplan, former ambassador and attorney, and Morty Lanning, as I mentioned. They formed the basis. They were the blue ribbon panel that we put together.
That's great. Thank you, Commissioner. I think it's really important that that panel was put together and the work was done prior to session. Any questions? Senator St. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, thank you for being here today. And I just have a question not related maybe to your initial comments, but as a new member, and one, frankly, that does not recall vividly the issue as it occurred last year. On the veto last year, can you talk to us a little bit about what the nature of that was all about so that we have at least, and I don't need a lengthy explanation, but just, you know, if there's a path down there that we're heading, that maybe we ought to know a little bit more about that so we don't cross that path twice.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a great question, and I'm happy to answer it. And I'll take at least less than an hour, I think.
Okay.
But to clear things up, this commission last year made some great progress on pension reform in general. But we were unable to pass the sort of the big package, if you will, last session. And there was a package that was passed with some technical changes. And one of the things that was included in the bill that was passed was some reduction in the COLA changes for retirees. And the governor really, and I think that's the focus and the key for what he recommends in his proposal, is shared sacrifice. He really wanted to make sure that the employer, the employee, the retiree, all make contributions and share in making sure that these pension plan changes are made. So it was really one of shared sacrifice, and he believed that that particular bill didn't satisfy that, and that was the reason for the veto.
Madam Chair,
Senator Benjamin.
And just to follow up so I understand, was it the situation where the commission had recommended COLA changes one way or another? That, which side of that issue was he on? A higher COLA change for the pensioners, or the other way around?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, the bill recommended lowering the COLA changes. And he's in support of those changes that are in this bill that actually lower the COLAs in the future. But he was not in support of doing only COLA changes for the retirees. He felt that the bill should also make contributions from the employer and the employee. So he wanted to make sure it was a complete package, not just one item.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Appreciate it.
Further questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Raton.
Yes, that's
okay,
correct.
Got it.
Would you like me to go through section by section or just highlight some of the big changes in the bill?
I would highlight.
Okay,
thank
great.
You. You have about 45 minutes.
I hope it doesn't take that long.
Okay.
Okay, so starting with Article 1, Section 1, this section is adjusting down the investment return assumption. And in this bill, it's adjusting it down for MSRS, TRA, and St. Paul teachers, bringing it down to the 7.5%. This is consistent with the proposals from MSRS and St. Paul teachers. The TRA board proposed adjusting it down to 7.5% for 5 years and then returning to 8%. One thing I also want to highlight is in the governor's bill, we did not do comprehensive changes to the PARA system, and that's because the governor didn't make a comprehensive recommendation on the PARA package, and so we would defer to the bill that was put forward by the PARA board. Then moving to paragraph B of that section, this relates to discounting future liabilities for the actuarial valuation. And deletes the language that relates to the automatic COLA increases. And later in the bill, you'll see where those automatic COLA increases are removed. And those are what folks had referred to as the trigger. Section 2 is an adjustment to...
Yes, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we leave Article 1, Section 2 is resetting the amortization period to 30 years. And I'm curious, are there some rules that we have to follow when we do that, or can we just, every time we do something, think that it's going to make it better, we get to do it? Or the reason I'm asking that is I remember from previous presentations here, it seems that about every 6 to 8 years we're resetting that, and to me it would be kind of like refinancing your mortgage every 7 or 8 years. You never get it paid off.
Ms. Rachon.
My understanding, Madam Chair, is that typically, when we do these kind of changes, they do adjust the amortization period out to the 30 years. I guess I would have to defer to someone with more actuarial expertise about whether that is prudent.
Representative Vogel, we are having Deloitte come up here towards the end, and perhaps they can answer that question, too.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, that'd be great. Further questions? Ms. Rachon?
So, as you said, Section 2 is an adjustment to the amortization periods for each of the plans, extending it out to 30 years to 2047. Section 3 is a new section that addresses the interest rate that is used when calculating payments of interest for refunds or repayments or additional contributions. What this does is beginning on June 30, 2017, the interest rate that would be used is adjusted to 7.5%. And that's adjusted to equal the new investment return assumption. And throughout the bill, you would see various updates to statutes striking specific interest rates that are included in law currently and replacing it with references to this new statute that would govern the calculation of interest. And then lastly, in Article 1 is a repealer, and this repealer is of Subdivision 1 of the section of statute that governs COLAs or post-retirement adjustments. And this is the section that would have gone to a 2.5% COLA if the fund had reached funding stability. And in this bill, they're permanently reducing the COLA to 1.5%. So any questions on Article 1?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to what I quickly looked at again in the bill and what I thought I heard the commissioner say was TRA 8% down to 7.5%, bounce back in 5 years to 8%. I don't see that in the bill. I just see it staying at 7.5%. Did I misunderstand, or am I missing it in the bill?
Mr. Rutan.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the governor's recommendation is for TRA to move to the 7.5% and remain at 7.5%.
That's what
which
I thought.
Differs from the, which
Thank
differs
you.
From
That's,
the TRA
That
board.
Is what I thought I understood as well, and as I looked at the bill, I did not see a bounce back date on there.
Yes.
So it does become a little difficult to tell the Board of Investment, get one rate of return for one group and get a different rate of return for a different group. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Rachon.
Okay, moving to Article 2. So Sections 1 through Section 3 of Article 2 are examples of those updates to the interest calculation statute, so we can kind of skip by those because those are kind of technical in nature. So skipping to Section 4. Section 4 is where there is the adjustment to the MSRS General Plan Employee Contribution Rate. This moves from 5.5% to 6%. And this is consistent with the recommendation of the MSRS board. Section 5 of Article 2 is where the employer contribution is adjusted, and it's phased in over time until the employer contribution rate equals 8%. The governor's recommendation has a slightly slower phase-in than is included in the MSRS bill. I think they phase it in over 3 years. The governor's recommendation is over 4. And then paragraph C in that section includes language that reduces the employer contribution rate down to 7% once the plan is fully funded. And that is also consistent with the proposal from MSRS. And then beginning with Section 6 through Section 9, these are, again, additional updates to statutes that require the calculation of interest. And so those are more technical. So moving to Section 10. Section 10 adjusts the employee contribution rates for correctional employees. It increases those by 0.5%. It's consistent with the MSRS proposal. Section 11 increases the employer contribution rate from 12.85% to 14.4% for correctional employees. This is the regular contribution rate for the employer. That part is consistent with the MSRS proposal. So Section 12 addresses the supplemental employer contribution. And the supplemental employer contribution is only in place until the plan is fully funded. It phases in a total of a 4.45% increase by fiscal year 2021. And the phase-in in the governor's bill is slower than was recommended by the MSRS board. And then there's language that would eliminate that supplemental contribution once the plan reaches full funding.
Ms. Raton, can you explain why the governor's plan, it does have a longer, through 4 years phase-in? What was the reasoning behind that?
So as we were looking at budgets and looking at the impact on state agencies, we wanted to give some time for agencies to adjust to that increased contribution and to phase in the funding associated with it. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see that in the governor's proposal as well in terms of how the funding phases in. So then moving to subdivision... Section 13 and 14 are once again updating references for the calculation of interest. Moving on to Section 15, this is an increase in the employee contribution for those in the state patrol plan, and it's consistent with the proposal from MSRS. Section 16 increases the employer contribution for members of the state patrol plan to 23.1% of salary, and this is also consistent with the MSRS proposal. And then again, similar to the correctional employees plan, there is a supplemental increase that phases in over time, fully phased in by fiscal year 2021. And again, the governor's bill is phasing this in at a slightly slower rate than the MSRS board recommendation. We can kind of skip through Section 17 through Section 22, because again, this is just revising current law for interest calculations, updating it to reference the new interest calculation statute that's included earlier in the bill.
Representative Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wright, I'm bad on words tonight. So you specify the technical nature in going specifically to this Section 356.59, where we're talking about the interest calculation. Is that an open-ended situation right now, or can we get some specificity in terms of how a person would calculate? What is it based on? You got to have a base. So what is the base?
Ms. Raton.
So typically that interest calculation would be based on the assumed rate of return. So the interest calculation is equivalent to whatever we are showing as the assumed rate of return in law. So for most of the plans currently, it's 8%. And when we adjust down the assumed rate of return to 7.5, we would then also adjust throughout law that interest rate assumption to 7.5 to match the assumed rate of return. Currently, throughout statute, there is reference to a specific number in each of these pieces of law, and that can get a little cumbersome to change if that interest rate is adjusted. And so what has been done in this bill and is consistent with the MSRS bill and the TRA bill, and I believe the PARA bill, is to create a statute that sets the interest rate and then simply reference that statute wherever there's a calculation of interest.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Just to expand a little bit on Representative Albright's inquiry. So if someone were to be, say, 15 years in arrears because of an error, and the commission does see those kinds of things popping up, interestingly enough, and I don't want to throw it out there, we haven't had any this year. We've got some carryover from last year, but we don't have any this year. Having said that, what happens if there was a multiple change in interest rates? We'll just lock it into whatever the real-time current rate is, or are we going to still go with the schedule for the periods of time? I think that's kind of what Representative Albright was driving at when he said it has to be a base number in which we're looking at. I was just trying to look up the statute reference on here. I don't see anything that drives us back to a base number on that.
Ms. Rachel.
So if you go to Section 3 in Article 1, it lays out the calculation of interest based on interest owed before July 1, 2015 at 8.5%, from July 1, 2015 to June 30, 2017 of 8%, and then going forward at the 7.5%.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the reference in stat in the bill doesn't necessarily refer back to that. On page 11, line 11.16 through 17, restates that same subdivision reference, if I'm not mistaken. And but inside the reference that she was talking about. Well, we can take that offline. I mean, I'm sure everybody's sitting at the edge of their seats trying to figure this one out, but we'll take it offline. How's that sound?
Certainly happy to meet with you about it. Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Rechon.
Okay, I think we left off at Section 23 of Article 2. Section 23 is where this section adjusts the COLA to 1.5% for all MSRS plans. Excuse me, except for the State Patrol and the judge's plan. The State Patrol plan is already at 1%, and they would stay at 1%. Section 24, the automatic COLA trigger increase is removed for the State Patrol plan. Section 25, this section restates and cleans up the language for the triggers in the judge's plan. Since the previous language removed triggers for all the other plans and then excluded the judges. And then Section 26 through Section 30, that those sections are, again, revising law to point to the interest calculation. So that is the end of Article 2. And then moving to Article 3, Article 3 is the TRA-specific proposals. And Section 1 is the increase in the employer contribution by a total of 2% phased in over 4 years for both coordinated and basic members. The TRA proposal did not include the increase in contribution for the basic members. Section 2 through Section 5 is, again, cleanup language referencing the new statute for the calculation of interest. Section 6, this is where the COLA is adjusted down to 1% per year for 5 years, and then in paragraph 3, the COLA is adjusted back to 1.5% beginning in 2023. And then paragraph B removes the automatic trigger that was in law that would have returned to a higher COLA once the fund reached stability.
Excuse me, Mr. Rayton. And members, there is a handout from the is this blue piece that shows the differences on the between the governor's plan and the TRA board plan. If you look at the very bottom of it, it goes through all the plans that way. It's kind of helpful. Ms. Rayton.
Okay, and then moving to Article 4, this is the article that is related to the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. Section 1 is just a change in terminology, so it's more technical. Section 2 through Section 4 are, again, sections that update the reference to the calculation of interest. Section 5 increases the employer contribution by a total of 2%, and it's phased in over 4 years. The St. Paul Teachers Board had proposed a 3% increase in the employer contribution. And then sections 6 through 9 are once again language citing the new interest calculation statute, and section 10 is a repeal of the automatic trigger for future COLA increases.
Excellent. Are there any questions for the commissioner or Ms. Riton? Ms. Riton, so there was no direct aid for St. Paul teachers, and can you just give us a reason why the Blue Ribbon panel did not feel it was appropriate to, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, members, you know, we wanted to support the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association or fund the plan as much as we could. We were able to do that with their increase in the employer contribution. Believe we were unable to meet their requested need for the direct aid. We just felt we didn't have the funds available to do that.
Okay. Also, if there's no questions, I have another one. So what does the governor's plan do for the Minsky employees that are not, that are with the TRA plan? That is not addressed at all, I don't think.
Similarly, when we were putting together the governor's budget, the governor funded quite a bit of the MNSCU operating ask, and so there just weren't enough funds available to fund the TRA portion that applied to MNSCU separately. But given the size of the operating increase that the governor recommended for MNSCU, that was the decision that was made.
Okay. And why does he not take into account the payroll growth assumption?
Madam Chair, members, it's purely a function of, once again, budget being concerned and believing that we have an opportunity next year, the year thereafter, to come back and revisit that. I mean, we wanted to fund all these proposals as much as we could, but we just felt like we didn't want to grow the spending in 20 and 21 without taking a further look at it to see what happens in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. And so the veto on the bill last year because of the shared sacrifice with their employer-employee, is that something that he feels strongly about this year as far as if the employer was not 100% funded going forward? Is that something that would cause great angst?
Madam Chair, well, I'm sure the governor assumes you'll fund it fully from the legislature. But, you know, that obviously that's a concern. We have to look at the balance here, and I think he'll have to take a look at that and see how it fits with the rest of the budget. But obviously a concern about not funding it would mean that it would be taken out of agency's existing budget. So it's just something he would have to look at. Mm-hmm. I don't know at this point what his response would be.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, stretching it over 4 years slows down the ability to get to the 90% funded, and that's okay with him too. Then, obviously, okay. So, any changes coming from the governor on this plan? Anything that he has expressed that since we have not talked, this plan has been out for quite a while. Is there anything that has cropped up?
Madam Chair, members, we've really looked this over pretty carefully last fall with the Blue Ribbon panel. And we really felt like the recommendations we made were really sound. And we're certainly, you know, open to suggestions or concerns or recommendations that the commission has. I mean, I wouldn't say that this is cast in stone by any measure. And we just felt that it was a starting point that was, if not fully funded in all ways, was mostly funded and really got us down the road. So we haven't made any changes at this point, but we're certainly hoping to have a dialogue with the commission about where we might be able to agree on this package.
Great. Further questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did address a couple of the questions that I had relative to that. Were there any changes or other recommendations and things that have come along the way? And Commissioner Franz, I appreciate your response that, you know, open to looking at different things because the commission has asked for some staff input, some actuary input on a couple of other different items that folks who have attended these meetings are familiar with some of those things, and the commission has not made any commitments one way or the other. They wanted information to see what the impacts would be. Which brings me to the second part of the question. Would you be the commission's contact person from the governor's office that we would want to start having regular meetings with to share with you thoughts and ideas when that time comes with 5 weeks left in the session on putting that finance plan together?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes, I would be the person that would be involved and look forward to that working together in the next 5 weeks to come to a conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator St. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who to address my question to, so I'll just ask it. I'm trying to understand, and just from a 10,000 foot, so to speak, how much does this cost, if you will, state government? And then how much does it cost local governments? If it's in here, I can't find it. Or I'm not able to understand it.
We're working on that, actually, too. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would go to slide 14 of the handout that you have. I'd go to it's number 14, and this is funding that's in the general fund budget. So there are a number. This is a complicated area. Obviously, there are a lot of employees who are not general fund employees that have to be dealt with in the other funds. And there's a separate sheet of paper that lists those employees. But for the general fund, if you look at the chart there, you see fiscal 18 and fiscal 19 for the school aid formula. So that approximately $65, $66 million, that money comes directly through the education, the school aid formula budget proposal that we have at that point. And if you look at the state agency funding, and you can see that on the other handout, we have a state agency funding at $8.2 million and $14 million for fiscal 18 and fiscal 19. And then we did recommend direct aid to the police and fire fund of $4.5 million a year. So if you add all those up for 18-19, the total for the general fund for both the education budget and the state agency budgets is $64.2 million. And then if you add them all together, I'm sorry, it's $99.8 million. So it's $137 million for 20 and 21. Now, granted, as Madam Chair has pointed out, these amounts for fiscal 20 and 21 are flat at this point. They don't reflect growth in compensation in other areas, and it's something we're going to have to address. But we frankly felt this is the most amount of money we could put into it at this time. So you see a almost $100 million general fund effort and about $137 million effort for 2021. Now for the local governments, that's not something we have available. A para might be able to provide that information.
Representative Driscoll.
And if you don't mind, I'll just pick up with where Commissioner Franz left off. Senator, there are, as it relates to state funding with the state patrol, that money comes out of what I'll call the gas tax fund. And so that's not a general fund expenditure when you heard the commissioner referring to general fund dollars on slide 14. So that would be something that would be less funds available and that's collected under sales tax on the gas tax right now, as those would be paid out to support the state patrol. Not that I'm saying that that's something that we shouldn't do. I've been often supportive of funding the state patrol in a different way on the general fund budget to be able to make sure that they got adequate funding from that source as well. Secondly, anybody that's covered under the PERA program, that is local units of government, counties, cities, school districts for non-certified, so anybody that's not a teacher that works for a school district, and so those dollars would be absorbed at the local budget level. The assumption is that the state makes payments to counties to program aid as well as local government aid, and yes, that would be a cost that the local governments would have to bear.
Right.
And it would be a direct increase in their costs if they didn't receive additional local government aid or county program aid. And the commissioner's right, it's off general fund, but it's still an expense that's associated with that. And to your question, being shifted to a different level or unit of government.
Senator St. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe bear with me a little bit. So, because I'm new, So we talk about being 77% funded. If we do this, are we 87% or 97% or 88% or
Madam Chair,
78%.
That's a very good question.
No, that's another really good question, and I think that each fund will be different. And so I think the key is the MSRS or the PERA or the St. Paul Teachers or the Teachers Retirement Association plan. Each one of those plans will be on a different special trajectory. So they will take this plan and implement it and show what that would, they'll model that and show what that would get them toward full funding, and it looks different for every single plan. We don't have that information in front of us, but we can get that for you.
Well, and Senator Sinjim, that begs the question, do you need to get 90% within how many years, 85%? I mean, you know, those
Madam
are
Madam Chair, I'm just kind of questions. Wondering about this trajectory, and,
right.
You know, we're trying to do it in 1 year or 10 years or whatever, and so mm-hmm. that information would be helpful for at least
Madam
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it would be. So we'll make sure we get those charts to you. One of the things that I think is important to realize that if we don't make these changes soon, all the lines are going to be going down and becoming more unfunded over time. And if we do make these changes, all the lines will be starting to trend upward again, some of them very, very healthily. And so it's they're not all on the same trajectory, but clearly this is one of those points in time that if we do make the right choices now, we can put them all on a path toward being fully funded. But the key is sort of over what time and how many years do you get to the 90% or the 100% funding.
And Representative Albright.
Commissioner Franz, you talk about the sufficiency that you're projecting for each one of the plans. Obviously, each plan has a different set of actuarial elements to it. And you speak to the Blue Ribbon Commission, and Chair Rosen asked about the individuals that were on that. I didn't hear their credentialing in terms of they were from an actuarial perspective or from an investment performance on an individual basis, or if they were folks that were specializing in the pension field within their organization, that type of thing. Not that that per se matters, but I think it adds an element of understanding in terms of an actuary's look at things as opposed to someone who's just looking at the bogey of 8% and how do you attribute that from a risk perspective. But more to my question in terms of what Senator Sinjim also said, I think it's incumbent upon us to appreciate where you're coming from or where the governor's coming from in terms of assessing the number. When you talk about 90-some million dollars, what does that mean per plan in terms of how do you provide sufficiency, and is sufficiency something that you attribute through this Blue Ribbon Commission by each plan, or is it something that the plan itself would also agree with? I'm looking for an understanding in terms of how you arrived at this level of quote-unquote sufficiency, and obviously you projected out 4 years, but there are tails beyond this to 2040. Where do we take this after the next two bienniums? Does it obligate the legislature to similar funding, or does this satisfy it for only the next 2 years, and then we have to reassess? So those types of explanations or narratives, I think, is missing from this commentary.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the key for us, and certainly what we did at MMB, was to take a look at what the plans had proposed. All the separate plans have sophisticated staff and use actuaries, and it was based upon the good work that they did in projecting where they felt that the unfunded liability direction was coming. And I think one of the things we relied upon was the sufficiency modeling that they were doing in terms of what was going to happen to their plans, given the market conditions that happened the last several years. As you may know, most of you may know, that most of the income earned by the plan, these plans, are based on return in the investment field, not by these contributions. And so by looking at what had happened the last, especially last year in 2016, where the market was flat or even a little negative, that is where the alarm bells, I know, for the plans really went off, and they were concerned, and obviously they were here last year talking about the need to make some of these changes. And so what's happened is by not making some of these changes last year and during the legislative session in 2016, it just makes the situation worse. And with the bad return year, then it compounds that situation. So what we did when looking and pulling together the Blue Ribbon panel was to get a number of people in the business area, the banking, the business area, the legal area, and the professor, the accounting area, the economist, was to get those folks to take a second look at what the plans were recommending, because we felt like, certainly I didn't at M&B, have the professional knowledge to second-guess the plans, if you will. And we wanted to have some folks take a look at how does Minnesota's unfunded liability compare to other states? How are we compared to the benefits that we pay and the contributions that are made? And by looking at all those factors, the Blue Ribbon panel believed that the plans and their recommendations were essentially sound and that they needed to be made, and that in order to be really sufficient going forward, we needed to make a change in the rate of return or the investment return assumption and lower that to from 8.0% to 7.5%. And part of that was also fueled by our recognition by the rating agencies that we meet with every year, who take a fine-tooth comb and go through and pour through our general fund obligation, debt obligations, and also our unfunded liability obligations. They go through those in excruciating detail. And the combination of listening to the rating agencies and their concerns, listening to the plans and their recommendations, and the actuaries that they made, the Blue Ribbon panel took a look at all those and made a recommendation to the governor that we really do need to make these changes, and we need to make them now in order to make sure that these funds are on a different trajectory. And I do believe all the plans would redo the period going forward at this time so that we would have a new, is it 30 years forward, starting now, looking forward as to how we would go forward. So, you know, what happens in the future really depends on what happens, for example, this year in the market and the next several years in the market. So we'll have to see how well we do. I mean, obviously, if the market stays where it is through the remainder of this fiscal year, we'll probably do fairly well. But I think the key is going forward, the recommendations that we're making, the governor's making, is trying to put these plans on the right trajectory and not realize we may have to adjust these in the future. I mean, the last time we made an adjustment was, I think,
2010.
So we hope that this is on a trajectory that lasts that long. But given the volatility of the markets and what might happen, we certainly can't promise that. So the goal really was to take what was there, have some professionals who are independent, have no vested interest in how these plans turn out, take a second look at this set of plans and their recommendations and see what they felt. And that's how we got the commission or the Blue Ribbon panel together to make recommendations to the governor. And he felt like their recommendations were something that he could support, and that formed the basis of the governor making funding recommendations that fund most, although not quite all, of these recommended plan changes.
Representative Albright.
I appreciate the answer, Commissioner, but I think one of the dangers or the perils that we continue to suffer from is where we mix the definitions of assumed rate of return and actual rate of return. And you and I have had this conversation, so I believe that we're speaking the same lingo, but I think, you know, if you take a look at the narrative of what a pension plan is, it is for the long term. You know, we're obligated by covenants and by commitments to the people that are participating in it to make sure that the money is there when they are looking for it. Hence, some of the changes that we're considering, reducing the rate of return or the assumed rate of return. That is different from the actual rate of return. And so when we talk about the assumed rate of return versus the realized rate of return, I think we have to be careful that we're not making decisions in the policy that is before us based upon the realized rate of return, because that will change from year to year. If you take an assumed rate of return and reduce it, it may necessarily assume less risk, which means that you smooth out the rates of return. But it also says that you're not going to get those big booms like we had in the late 90s, where everything was great, and then we saw the falloff because of the risk. But I think we need to be careful that we're not making decisions based upon what happened in the market last year, but that we make good policy decisions based upon what commitments we've made to assure that we can sustain not only the contribution and the rate of return, but that it's going to be there when the participants depart and plan on it. And that, to me, is at great peril when we start talking about what happened in the market last year and we start worrying about what we need to do in order to recover from that. So more of a commentary, Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, no, thank you, Representative. I think one of the things I've talked to you about and other members and Chair Rosen and Vice Chair O'Driscoll is about some other reforms. I mean, I think we need to think in the future about how do we manage this very issue going forward so that we don't see ourselves responding, you know, looking in the rearview mirror just a year or so behind, but kind of looking into the future. So I think there's some more things we can talk about in terms of when we have the rate of return exceeds our expectations, what do we do with that, with those funds? I mean, there's an opportunity sometimes to buy down your risk even more by lowering your assumed rate of return. So I think it's something that we can have a discussion about, thinking about how can we manage this liability going forward. But you raise some good issues.
Commissioner, I like to hear, I'm glad you said something about the reforms going forward, being nimble and being able to adjust, having the governor's proposal at an early stage, having you weighing in is very, very important, is a very powerful tool. Did the Blue Ribbon Commission or have you internally been talking about other reforms such as augmentation? We had a presentation by the commission staff here, Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth, on some other issues or other reforms that have been implemented around the states. And so I was wondering if you had a chance to look at that and if you have a comment on that.
Madam Chair, the Blue Ribbon panel did not have a chance to get that far down the road. We were under a pretty tight deadline to get done in December in order to give recommendations to the governor for his budget. But one of the things we did talk about was the need for reform. And I think we certainly want to make sure that these mechanisms work, as you mentioned, nimbly in the future. But we're certainly open to looking at reform ideas. We don't have any particular view on them at this time, though.
Okay, good. Well, that's good to know because we will be talking about that. And Representative Albright, I was just wondering if it's to the commission's wish, if this, the governor's proposal, if it's something that you would like to have our actuarial firm, Deloitte, to take a look at. I believe we have enough in the budget, and we could get a decision fairly quickly on that. Is that something that you would like to have?
Madam Chair, I think that would be another arrow in our quiver that as we move forward would be very beneficial to have at our disposal to consider. So, yes.
Okay. I would believe it's the chair's decision. And if it's something the commission would like, I certainly would request that. We won't take a vote, but I'm seeing some heads shake. So, good. Okay. We'll go ahead and commission that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I know that we have limited time, but this is probably the biggest thing that the commission is going to have to deal with this entire session is this stabilization plan. I just want to have folks take a look at the handout that the commissioner's office had brought forward for management and budget. If you go to page 8, and
So, Representative O'Driscoll, show the handout again so everybody is aware of the blue one.
Yeah, on okay. The handout, if you have that the commissioner's office had brought. If you look at the state patrol plan, and I think this really helps us to just show how important getting these things right are and making prudent decisions on how we move forward. If you take a look under the state patrol program, and I will make the caveat when I show you these numbers, that they are on the basic plan, they are not on a coordinated plan. So they, as employees, do not pay Social Security, nor does the state pay Social Security. But if you look at the second bullet point, it says employee contribution in 2020 would be at 15.4% of their wage, and the employer, the state patrol, would be at 30.1%. When you add those two numbers together, you are looking at 45% of an employee's wage that needs to be put into the pension plan to be able to get benefits that the state of Minnesota is making under this plan. So another way of looking at that is almost every 2 years you are putting in 100% of an employee's salary to pay that out as a benefit at the time of retirement, just to kind of put that into perspective. And not all plans are on the core or on basic, but we do have different smatterings of that within the system. So like I say, I just think that that's important that we look at that and what employees and employers are being asked to put in to be able to preserve those benefits. And that's one of the reasons we're having an extremely difficult conversation this year, because our actuarial reports have come back and said through the mortality tables, people are living longer, and so you're going to be paying out those dollars. So I hate to say this, but at some point in the future when we're all living to 125, you could be paying in 110% of your wage to get 100% back at a pension, and the clip that we're going at with past experience on this. I realize I'm throwing out a number for consideration, and it's not actuarially sound, but that's what you're seeing over time.
Yeah, very good point. Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Any further questions for the Commissioner or Mr. Rattan? Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your work on this, and we will be talking, but
thank you, Madam Chair.
This is very good. Thank you so much. Members, we're going to go back to our agenda item number one, the approval of the minutes. We have a quorum. I would entertain a motion to approve the March 21st, 2017 minutes.
So moved.
Senator Jedzinski moves that the approval of the minutes, March 21. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Do a little housekeeping. And from here, we are going to go to an amendment or to a new bill. It's item number 3. And if we could have Ms. Jones come up, please. Having to do with a volunteer firefighters relief association and para, and it's with Senator Lori and I forgot the House
Representative
member.
Sundin.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Welcome. Thank you,
Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Shayna Jones, Policy Director, PERA, and there is a technical amendment. So if you'd like to consider the 1A now, or
yes.
Wait for me to conclude.
Yes, we'll go ahead and just absorb that. The 1A is in your packet, members. And that's just technical? Okay. I'll need to take a vote. We're good. Thank you. I don't think I need to vote. No, I don't think so. Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, so PERA administers a statewide volunteer firefighter plan for local governments with entities who have volunteer firefighters that elect to participate. The plan was established in 2010, and currently we have over $50 million in assets and about 142 entities that do participate. Chapter 353G established an advisory board that advises our PERA Board of Trustees on issues related to the statewide volunteer plan. That board met in February and had 3 recommended changes for our PERA board to consider. They adopted all of those at their February meeting, and this bill is a representative of those 3 changes. The first change was to change the composition of the advisory board itself in Section 3 of the bill draft that you have in front of you, so that the number of members appointed by the Minnesota State Fire Department's Association matches the number appointed by the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. That's change number 1. Change number 2 in Section 5 is to make sure that the annual maximum service level pension is able to match that in Chapter 424A for all other volunteer relief associations, so it's just simply a cross-reference. And then the third and most substantial change coming out of this bill was brought forward by a constituent of Representative Sundin and Senator Lori. And so we have resolved their issue and then taken it broadly. Right now, once an entity opts to join the statewide volunteer firefighter plan, there's no way for them to leave the plan. The impetus for the advisory board considering a broader change, of course, was the City of Wright was going to merge with the City of Cromwell. And one of them was in our statewide volunteer plan, and one of them was in had their own relief association plan. And there was no direction in law that would allow a merger or a transfer to occur. So our advisory board felt that this issue wasn't specific to just those 2 entities, but this was a broader issue that maybe other statewide volunteer plan participants or relief associations might face. And so they looked at this and took an approach where they would solve this issue on a forward basis. So there is now language that allows for entities to withdraw from the PERA SVF plan and go take their assets and their liabilities and put those into a relief association plan. Our advisory board actually felt that this was a roadblock for entities joining our statewide volunteer plan, and that more might come in just with knowing that they might be able to get out in the future, even though in reality they probably won't leave because they're usually happy with the plan once they're in. So for the entities to transfer or withdraw from the statewide volunteer plan, sections 1, 2, 4, and 6 combined allow for this to happen and establish rules, and very broadly, essentially the statewide volunteer plan governing entity, the local government, has to approve the transfer. The relief association that they're transferring to must approve the transfer, and then the active firefighters in the statewide volunteer plan must also approve the transfer. This bill, coming to you at this stage of the game, really has had significant input from all stakeholders and parties involved, and so we think that it's agreeable to all of our stakeholders and don't view it as controversial. Ask for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Are there any questions on the bill? Okay, with that, Representative Driscoll, would you like to move? I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Jones, is there any section in the bill that would speak to indemnification for the departing agency or department from the plan itself if there was to be found an error in the calculations, and kind of as a look-back indemnification?
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, there may be some language in, still finding it, on page 6, and I will ask Ms. Lincheski to kind of weigh in here, but I'm not sure if what's in subdivision 5 on page 6,
Ms. Lincheski,
suffices for what you're looking for.
Senator Rosen, Representative Albright, I guess I'll just ask back to you if you would clarify. Are you thinking back to those errors or the situation we had where there were people stuck in the statewide, or they sort of thought that because they now were going to be required to pay higher benefits than they could afford? This would allow for that, but they'd have to have a relief association to which assets would be transferred. So as long as they set up a relief association and then were, you know, ready to go, and these firefighters then could leave the statewide plan, go to this relief association, and then the transfer of assets could follow. So that would be permitted under this bill.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Ms. Lincheski, so it, to the best of your knowledge, under Subdivision 5, that would relieve the departing agency from having to come up with additional monies based upon a calculation after the fact for benefits sometime in the future.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, Representative Albright, Madam Chair, I am...
When they won't have any money.
Right. Yeah, so this protects the benefit that they have accrued to date under the statewide plan. So my thought, and I haven't given this lots of thought at this point, but my guess is that if they haven't actually accrued or earned that higher benefit, because there was that sort of 5-year period, that transitional period, that there would be no protection for that larger benefit. They'd only get the benefit to which they had become entitled, and that would then transfer over to the new relief association.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and for Ms. Jones, I'm just wondering if maybe we could have a little follow-up on that just to make sure that I'm understanding the language, and maybe for the benefit of those that would be looking to this for constructive relief, that they have something in statute that answers that question more explicitly.
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, fair enough. We'll follow up.
Thank you.
Representative Albright, are you saying that you would not like a vote on this, or you just want to follow up?
Madam Chair, I'm trusting in people of above my pay grade right now. Ms. Lincheski seems to have it well in hand, and I'll trust her knowledge of the statement and proceed accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line, let's see, 6.1, where it says, may deduct from the assets to be transferred reasonable cost incurred. And fairly open as far as what could be included there. My concern would be that if you have a small fire department and you're using a downtown attorney at $400 an hour or whatever, or I don't think this would cause a liquidity crisis or whatever if securities had to be liquidated or whatever to make the transfer, what is meant by reasonable cost? Because that could be broadened out and could really impact whether or not somebody would want to withdraw or could actually afford to.
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, the intent of that language was more administrative in nature. Putting plans into the SVF plan and then thus taking them out of the plan is the most administratively cumbersome piece of this and can take up to maybe 8 hours of staff time. And so it was just protection for the agency that if plans want to withdraw, that they're paying the staff time for us to administer that type of a change and not, we wouldn't be going outside of the agency for any services to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Vogel. Further questions? Members, I think we are going to vote on the 1A amendment. I'd feel better with that. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I will move the 1A amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. So we have the 17-4474 as amended before us. Further questions? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I would move that 17-4474 as amended be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Jones. Now, members, we have a item number 4 is a resolution ahead of us. And it's a motion that is, we'll have Deloitte, thank you, before us. And it's a resolution that actually I think I'm going to have Ms. Lincheski review, but it's something that I think is, I feel strongly about that we should ask and receive from the plans on especially item number 1, and that's in your packet. So, Ms. Lincheski. Okay. That's a good idea. Okay. Change of plans. Welcome, Mr. DeLeon. Would you please go through this motion, please, for us? What you're suggesting.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Thank you. Michael DeLeon with Deloitte Consulting. I plan to walk through a brief presentation about what we did, some of the background of what these recommendations that are part of this motion include. So if you have this in front of you, I'll just step through something very quickly here. You're only looking like people have this.
Who's got that?
Okay, good. So basically, each year or every 2 or 3 years, the commission directs the actuaries your actuary Deloitte to review the plans of the systems at a high level, and then on a rotating basis, one of the major plans to do a full replication, where we basically independently perform an actuarial evaluation, just like the systems do, and determine if we come up with much of a different answer. This year, we completed the review of all the plans because of the experience study and the new assumptions that were brought in. So we were asked to look at the plans again and see if those assumptions were incorporated appropriately. So I'll start with page 4 of this, basically just kind of what I mentioned about our scope. We look at the reasonableness of the results of the actuarial evaluation and if they're compliant with the Minnesota statutes, the standards of actuarial work, and general actuarial standards of practice. And we do this by reviewing the census data, by pulling individual sample lives and testing them. In this case, we took 93 across all the plans and tested those individuals to see if those results were reasonable. Were the assumptions incorporated? And then if we come up with any differences, we work with the systems, with their actuaries, to understand any differences, go back and forth on any difference of opinions or anything like that, and then come up with a report of our findings. On page 5, we have a summary of the results of that analysis. Basically, overall, we didn't find any major concerns. We found that all the results were reasonable, so we thought, you know, that you can trust the results of those valuation reports. We do have some recommendations that we made relative to how we thought the report could be improved to provide additional useful disclosure information, for example, around the sensitivity of certain assumptions, the ability of the actuary to look at other assumptions in the future, and specifically around how those that elect a refund of employee contributions. So currently it's required that they assume everyone will just take a refund. We thought it'd be useful for them to be able to look at that assumption, consider whether other actual experience is different than that assumption, and that consideration of best practices and funding policies, that be reviewed, and then finally that the actuarial equivalence definition that is used in their administration of these of certain factors around early retirement reduction factors and adjustments for optional benefit forms also be updated to be consistent with the most recent experience studies. Most of these recommendations are actually similar to what we recommended 2 years ago in 2015, which is, I believe, part of the reason that the motion came about. But, you know, we're and just to briefly highlight that, I believe the general idea of the recommendation of this motion is that to ask the systems and their actuaries to basically to respond to our recommendations formally with either making the changes that we're recommending or noting why they would prefer not or choosing not to make those recommended changes. Just to briefly go through the Teachers Retirement Association starting on slide 7, this is similar except that we go into more detail. We do a completely independent actuarial evaluation. We take the census data that is provided to TRA and we program it into our software using our methodologies, again, go through the process of determining what the liabilities are of the plan, you know, all of the similar things that are being done by the systems actuary and report back on any differences. And again, if there's anything we're not understanding or coming up with different results with the actuaries, the systems actuaries, we discuss it with them. And in both cases, the systems themselves and the actuaries have been very cooperative and very helpful throughout this process, so we certainly appreciate that. On slide 8, the results of the report of our analysis is basically that we came within 1% of the results that the actuaries did. On the key metrics, and really we consider within 2% a reasonably close. Actuaries use slightly different methods in doing their calculations and different software, so there are reasons why it can be a little bit different with these type of complex calculations, so we felt that that these being within 1% is certainly reasonable, so we felt that you could, again, rely on the results of these actuarial evaluations. There were a couple of minor things that we found that we recommended being changed in addition to the general recommendations we had for all the other plans, specifically around how death benefits were being calculated for terminated vested participants. But, you know, again, nothing that's going to significantly change the results, but just some sort of housekeeping cleanup that we think should be made going forward. Happy to answer any questions about that.
Thank you, Mr. DeLeon. Questions? Okay, wonderful. Then I will turn this over to Ms. Lincheski. She can go through the following resolution that's before you in your packet, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, I'll just provide a little bit of context with regard to the replication that Mr. DeLeon talked about. A replication is basically redoing the actual valuation, and we do the plans. We do one plan each year. So we're in the third year of doing that. We did MSRS the first year, second year, which was just last year. We did PARA. This year we're doing TRA. So just to give a little context, in addition to redoing the valuation for a plan, Deloitte also reviews all of the actuarial valuations. It doesn't actually redo the valuation, but it reviews them, and hence then we get these recommendations from Deloitte. So the motion, which is LCPR 17-M2, takes the recommendations that Deloitte provided to us, and they are sort of our arm. They are our experts that the commission uses to make sure that what the plans are doing with their actuaries are consistent with what Deloitte feels they should be doing in their reports. So Deloitte had recommendations. 2 years ago, those recommendations were not incorporated into the valuations for the plans. So this year, in an attempt to get the plans to take into account those recommendations, this motion then would require them to do that. If they don't want to incorporate the recommendation, they need to then give an explanation or a reason as to why they will not be doing that. So that's what this motion does. And so there's three parts to the motion. The first part is the main part. That's the part that directs that the recommendations of Deloitte be taken into account in the next valuations that are done by the actuaries for each of the plans. So that's pages one and half of page two. These are fairly technical, but they draw straight from the reports. And we do have copies of the reports available. They are also posted on our website. They look like this, and they're fairly long. They're about 40 pages each. Very technical, but if you are interested, they can be pulled off the website, or we have copies here for you. So the recommendations that are in the motion pull straight from these reports. Part two of the motion is something that was uncovered in the course of doing some work on the unclassified plan, actually, for MSRS. It was, we sort of discovered that the factors that are used to convert, say, a single life annuity to a joint survivor annuity were not taking into account the new assumptions that had been approved by the commission. So back in early 2016, the commission did approve all new assumptions for the plans, and you may remember the big color sheet that we had. It was a 7 or 8 page document. Those were approved. By law, the plans are supposed to take those assumptions and work them into their factors that they use for converting one form of benefit to another. Also, for the plans, they are also supposed to use these factors in taking a normal retirement benefit and bringing it down to an early retirement benefit. So those are supposed to take into account the current factors. We discovered that that, in fact, was not being done. So the second part of the motion directs the plans to basically follow the law. So we've listed all the statutes, and to the extent they apply to the plan then should take into account the new assumptions in determining these factors. There is a transition period here that is an allowance so that they can do whatever they need to do with their programming to make that happen, but that's what the point of number two is, or the second part of this motion. The third part is really to put the commission, I guess, sort of on notice that hopefully over the interim we're going to update the standards for actuarial work that have been around for a long time and are very much in need of updating. We already do have comments from Deloitte on that, and we'll work, we'll do additional work with Deloitte and with the plans to update this this lengthy document that is to direct the plans as to how the actuaries should apply certain factors, certain discretionary, features in doing their actuarial valuation. So this third one just directs the staff to proceed with doing the update, and the thought was then that the commission could review those, review the update, and then hopefully adopt it at the next session in 2018.
Are there any member questions at this time before we ask for plan comment or public comment? Representative Murphy.
Mr. De Leon, you said that the plan would have to explain if they weren't going to follow or incorporate the recommendation. And is that explanation in writing then back to Deloitte or back to the commission?
Mr. De Leon.
Representative Driscoll, Representative Murphy, the I believe the way the language is written, I can refer back to Ms. Nacheski, but the is that it provide the explanation in the actuarial evaluation, that in that public report that they provide, that that's where they make the statement if they're not changing, if they're not making a recommend, if they're not changing something based on the recommendation.
Representative Murphy, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lencheski, then, what happens if they don't?
Ms. Lencheski.
And who does Deloitte go after them, or do we go after them?
Ms. Lencheski.
And how do we do that?
Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Murphy, there can be a difference of opinion among experts. And so really all we're looking for is an explanation of why there is a difference on this point. It doesn't make one right or the other wrong. It's really just understanding whether there's, you know, some disagreement among the experts here, the actuaries. As long as there's an explanation, we've done our due diligence. We can read that explanation, understand why they're taking a different approach, and I think that should be resolved to our satisfaction. I don't think that there would need to be anything coercive about this. I don't think there's any requirement that there isn't any requirement here that the actuaries follow what Deloitte says, but at least we would know why there is a different approach.
Representative Murphy, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, so what do we do with it? What does the commission do with it, with that new information?
Representative Murphy, if you were asking me, I think we would have that information back here in front of the commission, and we would go and ask the plans why they haven't done what they've done and ask them questions just like we do tonight on their soundness of deviation from the recommendations, and then we would decide yes or no that that's appropriate. That would be my thoughts.
And then, Mr. Chair, at what point then do we receive or the recommendations from Deloitte and go over what we think about those recommendations that they're giving to the plans? Do we review them before they give them to the plans, or is after it's all done?
Representative Murphy, I'm going to defer to staff for the timeline on that, if that makes sense. Ms. Lencheski?
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Murphy. The recommendations are in these reports. We could certainly ask Deloitte to go through the recommendations. They are summarized in the motion, but if you'd like, Mr. DeLim would certainly be willing to walk through these recommendations, since they have done a very thorough review and a very thorough report, and I think we would have a better understanding of what they are if you'd like to do that.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Ms. Lencheski, I think maybe I want to be absent from that meeting, but... I'm just curious about this whole thing. We've never had a resolution before that I can remember. And so it's a new tool we're using for our toolbox. And I don't know if my toolbox is big enough for that.
Maybe we have to buy you a different toolbox, Representative Murphy.
Thank you for the clarifications.
Any other member discussion before I ask if there are any plan reactions and or public? Seeing no members, anyone from the public or the plans wishing to come forward to testify? Ms. Leonard? Good evening, Ms. Leonard. If you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, I apologize, and members. I just wanted to add one point of clarification on item number 2 related to the implementation of reduction factors. MSRS general and unclassified, we actually did implement those factors after our experience study. So we've already done that, and we are in the process of doing it for our other plans, but the experience study was 1 year delayed. So I just wanted to add that clarification because I don't know that that was entirely clear.
So, Ms. Leonard, you're already undertaking this without the resolution directive, if you will.
Yes, they're already implemented and programmed, and participants are receiving statements with that information.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Leonard? Seeing none, thank you. Thanks. Other member plans, public thoughts on the matter? Mr. Stoffel, and then Mr. Heller will come to you. Mr. Stoffel, welcome. If you'll go ahead and identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jay Stoffel, Deputy Executive Director for the Teachers Retirement Association. When we saw the motion that was posted on the Pension Commission's website, we sent it off to our actuary for their review and comment. And they got back to us and saying, for the most, I mean, we can, these are fine. It's unusual. I think this is the first time we've seen something like this for as long as I've been around. But they're workable. We can work with this, the requirements that are in this motion. But one comment that we did receive that I thought was worth letting you know is that as Mr. De Leon, or I think Susan Lincheski pointed out, some of the differences that crop up, the reasons are for there's just different professional judgment that's used by different actuarial firms. They have different methods, they have various calculations, and that those experts can differ. For the most part, the differences are going to be very insignificant. But what the motion does, and I guess to explain a little bit about what I'm referring to, if you look on page 3, Roman numeral number 3, the first bullet point, talks about an assumption regarding contribution refunds and that the assumption should be based on actual experience. So now we have some very specific language on how to use an assumption. And our actuary pointed out, well, that really ties their hand. We can't use any other kind of judgment or process or thinking about that kind of an assumption. And what they said was there's actual experience. That's looking backwards. But when a law changes or a plan provision changes, there could be a change of behavior. So you want to look forward and sort of anticipate what members' reactions to a law or a benefit change might be. So this requirement really just forces us to look backwards. You can't look forward. You can't use expected behavior or expected experience. We have to look at actual experience, which is backward looking. So in a way, I mean, and again, this is all very insignificant differences, but it does, so I guess from TRA's perspective, we can live with this motion, but it does in some small degree tie the hands of the actuaries to use more prescribed methods when setting some of these assumptions.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. Any questions for Mr. Stoffel this evening from members? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Heller, good evening and welcome. You'll identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Hello, Legislative Commission of Pension and Retirement. My name is Rick Heller, a son of a carpenter, a fireman, and more. Unofficially represent those who are twice exceptional print disabled. I come here to testify on the 18th at the Minnesota Senate building regarding accessibility of your own documents. I've been following these bills for quite a while. One of your handouts, frankly, that talk about House File XXX is not compliant American Disability Act. And when you introduce bills, they don't come fully accessible until they're read on the floor. And obviously at discretion of each individual that has the bill to provide it, but it's not fully accessible. Also, your agenda, the header from the LCC is not fully accessible. The bottom page is not fully accessible, yet it requires Adobe Reader read out loud. I look for fairness and sameness and transparency to a process for everybody as relates to access in a timely manner. But for me to come to these meetings and having handouts that are not currently online are not very fair and sameness and transparent for anybody that want to do their homework and come to these meetings. I can't do that. and perhaps there's other individuals that want to be engaged in this process, and it's a barrier. My suggestion that you apply Jason expressed in a correspondence of Data Practice Commission. I provided some handouts on March 3rd there, Heller handouts. On page 6 talks about how these documents become more fully accessible that are in PDF and HTML until JAWS, the specialized software that reads those documents, were struck through another language so they can understand it and be engaged in a process. This place is not fair in that way. And if we all live long enough, we're going to lose our vision. You need to consider the aspects of that, too. And hopefully, if you're going to have a resolution, you might consider a resolution tonight about applying that to the Zone Commission, or, in fact, the LCC Commission, because they do not have an accessibility policy. And Greg, the director of LCC, testified in Kiff Myers' Government Operations Committee that it does not have an accessibility policy. We have a building that's more accessible than it's ever been, but when it comes to the content, we're not there yet. And I suggest you follow Minnesota Statute 16E.03, Subdivision 9, which requires state agencies to make sure that content is usable and accessible with the assistive technology. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. And I would suggest talking with Mr. Hubinger on these issues, too. That would be worth your while. Thank you.
I appreciate if you are going to talk to him and you start a correspondence, that you copy this committee and copy me on it, because I can't get any effective movement even after my discussion with Greg this evening, after you talked to the Speaker of the House. So
thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. Further questions on the resolution? Members, we're going to go ahead and take a vote on this resolution. I think it's important to make sure that we are working with Deloitte, our actuarial firm hired by the commission. And is there any further questions, comments on this resolution? And it's just a resolution. Representative Driscoll, would you like to move this resolution, please?
I'm not known by that name. I'm known by a number of names, but Representative...
Mr. Albright, my vice chair.
I've got a pair of glasses if you need. Madam Chair, I would move the PR 17-M2 resolution.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Albright. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, members, that is it for this evening, 7 o'clock, pretty close. And we will be continuing to work. I do not have an agenda for next week, but we will be in touch with that. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.